This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The angels from on high assume, quite rightly, that they're in. The Red Sox and the Indians can hardly fail to win positions in the playoffs, and the Mets are likewise sure. But as has always been the case, the Cubs fans must endure another stretch where heartbreak is as likely to ensue as raucous celebration. What's a Cubbies fan to do? That's just one of the questions I'll put to ESPN baseball guy Tim Kirchen, who joins me now. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. The feel-good story of the summer was, of course, the return of failed pitcher Rick Ankiel to the Cardinals as a hitter. And then, oops, we learned that Ankiel had purchased human growth hormone. Commissioner Selig has now said this week that when a blood test for the presence of human growth hormone becomes available, Major League Baseball will test its players. Will the players' union go along with that policy?
I can't see that happening, certainly not right now, Bill. There is no real reliable test for HGH, and the union, which is going to be against blood testing anyway, especially a blood test that isn't 100% certain, I cannot imagine the union going for that anytime soon. This is going to take a long time, and I mean years, before a reliable test is formed, and B, that the union goes along with it. The union has come so far on the whole drug testing issue, and it had to come this far. They don't deserve all the credit in the world, but they have come a long way. But they're not going for blood testing anytime soon, from what I can tell. And until there's a 100% reliable test, baseball isn't going to have this as part of their function.
Assuming that St. Louis doesn't suddenly win as many games in a row as they have just lost, either the Cubs or the Brewers will finish first in the National League Central Division. Can Cubs fans legitimately hope for a division title and more?
Well, I think they can win the division, and I think they can go to the World Series. Now, I'm not suggesting that's going to happen, because to me, clearly, the best team in the National League right now is the Mets. However, we learned last year from the Cardinals, who won 83 games, that you can win the World Series with a pretty ordinary team as long as you get hot at the right time. And the Cubs are capable of doing that. I still have big questions about their pitching, and it's very rare that any team wins three playoff series in October without really exemplary pitching, and they don't have it right now. But, again, we've learned from this year more than anything, there are no great teams out there. Anybody can fall, and just about any team can win it, including the Cubs.
Well, otherwise, the intriguing races are between the teams looking to make the playoffs via the wild card route. What are the chances that the Phillies might creep into that mix?
The Phillies have some major issues right now, Bill. They've got the Padres ahead of them, and they've got some pitching issues that have been with them all year, and I don't think they're going to make it. Of course, I picked them to win the wild card at the beginning of the year, but I don't think I'm going to be right on that one. So we'll see. I mean, they still have a dynamic offense. They could get hot the last 2.5 weeks and really do something, but my guess is Diamondbacks win the West, Padres win the wild card.
In the American League, the Yankees and the Red Sox play this weekend. Boston has been playing well enough so that it doesn't look as if the Yankees will finish on top of the Eastern Division, which is certainly an unusual occurrence. But assuming both teams make the playoffs, which one looks stronger for the postseason?
Well, I think the Yankees look like the best team in baseball at this moment. Now, they've had all sorts of issues getting to this moment, and they still have their share of problems like every other team in the game. But they are so hot right now. Their offense is absolutely relentless. They are by far the highest scoring team in Major League Baseball right now. And their pitching is starting to come a little bit closer to coming together with injuries, you know, starting to heal finally. They've got their bullpen figured out a little bit with Jabba Chamberlain up from the minor leagues. So I don't think it's out of the question that they are the team to beat in the American League going into the playoffs. But again, any of those American League teams can make it to the World Series. There are no great teams left.
The Mariners have allowed the Angels to cruise to the title in the Western Division of the American League. Will the lack of tension over the last couple of weeks mean Anaheim goes into the postseason too relaxed?
I don't think so. I saw the Angels this week in Baltimore, and Mike Socia must have said 50 times, if we make it to October. And you know he's getting to October, but he's a very cautious guy. And the thing about the Angels is they've had so many injuries this year that they have developed an extremely productive bench based on the fact that a lot of guys who weren't supposed to play played every day for a couple of months to take care of all those injuries, and now they're going to go into the postseason with maybe the deepest team in baseball. And the one thing that's got to scare the Yankees is they've had an awful lot of trouble with the Angels in recent years. The Angels love to run the bases. They love to put pressure on defenses that aren't particularly good, and the Angels could give the Yankees real trouble in the postseason.
Tim, the AL Central has been the division in which a different team has seemed to bubble to the top each season. This year it's Cleveland's turn. How far can CC Sabathia et al. Take the Indians?
Well, he might win the Cy Young. He might be the best pitcher in the American League. It's certainly debatable. And with Fausto Carmona as the number two and Paul Byrd as the number three, not your classic 2-3s, but guys who've been very good this year. Their bullpen has been much better. They've improved their defense dramatically, and they've gotten some real offensive production from some common guys, you know, Victor Martinez and others. But they've really proven a lot. They've got a lot of guts and a lot of heart on that club, and it's very impressive how they've played this year.
All right, Tim, you've already kind of excused yourself from any number of previous predictions. I'm going to give you a chance now to revise everything, beginning now, and tell me who's going to win this whole thing.
Well, first off, I picked the Yankees to beat the Mets in the World Series at the beginning of the year, and I still have a chance to be right about that. So given that, and I'm not being stubborn here, I'm going to stay with the Yankees beating the Mets in the World Series, just because I think in 2007, even though pitching obviously is the most important thing that everyone must have, the Yankees can just outslug a lot of people, and they can hit their way through a lot of mistakes, and that's what I think is going to happen. So I'm saying they're going to beat the Mets in the World Series, just like I said in March.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN.com. He also joins me from time to time here on Only a Game. Thanks very much, Tim.
My pleasure, Bill.
Late last month at Tropicana Field in Tampa, Florida, home of the Devil Rays, Cheryl Cruz, a fan of the visiting team, reminisced about some of her proudest moments.
The heckler sits right over there, and he was surrounded by Red Sox fans, absolutely surrounded.
Cheryl Cruz is a Red Sox fan who has no use for a heckler, even if the heckler is at home.
And he left in the fifth inning. He has season tickets because he has his name on the seats for him and his three boys. And they left in the fifth inning because we just heckled the heck out of him.
Red Sox fans frequently outnumber Devil Rays fans at games in Tampa. They often outnumber Orioles fans at games in Baltimore, too, and White Sox fans at games in Chicago, where Mark McGillivray of Quincy, Massachusetts, recently watched the White Sox host his Red Sox and found he had lots of company.
The more we travel, the more we see more Red Sox fans. Well, in actuality, it's easier to get a ticket out here than it is to get a ticket in Fenway, so that's why there's more Boston people out here. But it's also because it's a great weekend. You get to travel, beautiful girls. But yeah, it's fun. It's fun to follow the team.
Among those raising their glasses to McGillivray's notion were Colleen Murphy and Helena Richardson, two more Bostonians. They were asked to comment on the perception that when they travel, Boston supporters sometimes strike fans of the home team as terrible.
We are loud and we are obnoxious, but we're good fans, we're loyal.
And it's out of love, baby.
We love the Sox, kid. That's all I got to say about it.
I think they're confusing terrible with passionate. We're passionate.
Passionate and numerous and sometimes inclined to feel entitled.
Let's go Red Sox! Let's go Red Sox!
At a recent Orioles home game, Red Sox fan Kyle Era, who had traveled from Connecticut, was asked whether he and his fellow Sox fans felt they owned Camden Yards.
Tonight, for the weekend, when Boston's in town, yeah. It's like Fenway, home away from home.
Among the surprising sights at Camden Yards that evening, at least to those unfamiliar with the migratory habits of Red Sox fans, was the body art sported by Will Tewksbury, down for the game from Maine.
I got a tattoo right there, so it's a boss. It's the B logo with a couple of dangling socks hanging off the B. It is on my right arm, on my right bicep.
Carter Gaddis, who covers the Devil Rays for the Tampa Tribune, was at Fenway Park for this week's series against the Devil Rays. He's been at the ballpark in Tampa on lots of nights when Red Sox fans have outnumbered supporters of the home team. He says that as far as the Rays are concerned, that's not always such a bad thing.
And you know what the players say a lot of times is they actually feel more energized when the opposing fans are in the stadium than they do on a normal night, say when the Orioles or the Indians are in town and Tropicana Field has about 10,000 people, if that. But it's pretty natural when you see, say, 35,000 fans and 25,000 of them are Red Sox fans. Seriously, the Devil Rays will kind of feed off of that. And a lot of times if something good happens for the Devil Rays, you'll see the Red Sox fans cheering just as hard for the Devil Rays as they do for the Red Sox.
Among the members of the Devil Rays, neither intimidated nor discouraged by all those opposition fans when the Rays play at home, is Tampa Bay manager Joe Maddon, who believes the circumstances will change when his team starts winning.
In a perverse way, I actually enjoy it too. It's deserved. I mean, until we do what we're supposed to do, you're going to get that kind of ambivalence, and that's okay. And we're getting better, like I said, and it's going to be fun to see it flip and tip in our favor down the road. And I'm not an I told you so kind of guy, but it's going to be kind of fun to watch the whole thing.
Outside Fenway Park on Wednesday night, a couple of hours before Madden's Devil Rays would play the Red Sox, a glimpse into the future Maddon envisions was available in the person of Kristen Manfredo. She lives in Massachusetts, and she's something of a curiosity since she was not coming to Fenway to root for the home team. In fact, Kristen may be the world's most passionate Devil Rays fan.
Yeah, we actually have season tickets down in Tampa, and we've seen them in Anaheim, Oakland, Philly, Miami, Baltimore, New York. We get around.
That night, she saw them in Boston from right behind the visitors' dugout. And if, as a fan of the visiting team, Kristen Manfredo was a lot lonelier than all those Sox fans are in Tampa Bay, Chicago, Baltimore, and so on, she never complained. Even after her team lost the 4-run lead they'd built against the Sox and then lost the game in the bottom of the ninth. It's 19. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, soccer in South Africa. But first, last Sunday, an employee of the New England Patriots was caught filming sideline conversations between members of the coaching staff of the New York Jets, who were playing the Patriots at the time. On Thursday, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell fined Pats coach Bill Belichick $500,000. The team was fined an additional $250,000 and will have to forfeit at least a first-round draft pick. Joining me now to discuss this outrage and its context is Paul Attner. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be back, Bill.
An NFL commissioner has never had to rule on something quite like Cameragate before. Did the punishment fit the crime?
You know, I really don't think it does, Bill, in the context of what new Commissioner Roger Goodell has been doing with players. But I think it was worth a suspension. I really do. I think money, as we've seen with players, doesn't mean as much as not being able to participate. And Belichick lives for Sundays and the plotting and the planning. And to get him out of there, you know, take him, put him down for a couple of weeks. And I think that would have been a much stronger message both to him and to his peers, because this stuff is going on. Maybe not to the degree the Patriots push the envelope, but there's stuff going on all the time, every week in this league, that if it doesn't violate the rules, it bends them considerably. And it needs to stop. And it needs to be a strong message sent to these guys to stop it.
The Patriots in this decade have been known for always being the smartest and best prepared team, a team that is always 12 steps ahead of its opponent at least. Does this business this week cast doubt about how they obtained their so-called intelligence over all these years?
Well, no, I don't think it casts complete doubt over, but yeah, it adds a little bit of hesitation. He certainly is not going to be anointed anymore as the reigning genius, because he's always going to have this trailing behind him, and rightfully so. He is a very smart guy, and that's what the shame of all this is, Bill. He's a very, very intelligent guy who I think is one step ahead of the league in a lot of ways, but in this case he was, you know, illegally one step ahead. He doesn't need this to win, but he is so paranoid and so obsessed and is bending things all the time, and you know, we kind of laugh about among the media that, you know, we never can trust anything the Patriots do. Well, there's a reason for that. I mean, he doesn't seem to want to stay completely within the rules, and he's going to try to push it until somebody slaps on the hand like a little kid. So, yeah, it has damaged his reputation, and everybody's going to look back now and say, oh, boy, I wonder if they stole our signals. That's the reason they were able to march at the end and win that game.
Paul, the league has a rich history of cheating, and by golly, the Patriots have been right at the center of it lots of times. How does this Cameragate business compare to the infamous snowplow game where a convicted burglar on work furlough was ordered to clear a spot so the place kicker could more easily make his kick?
Well, the league was comfortable in that one because they let him do it. They let him sit there, you know, let him plow the thing. I mean, there's a rich history of alleged cheating. In that case, the game officials allowed the guy to do it, so really it wasn't cheating. My favorite story really involves Al Davis because he really is the center of the great cheaters of all time, supposedly. he used to have a great rivalry, Oakland versus San Diego back then. He came from San Diego, and the Chargers are absolutely convinced that Al Davis bugged the visitor's locker room in Oakland. And there's a great story that a Chargers coach one time, Harlan Savari, at halftime of a game, looked up at a light hanging down from the locker room and said, "Damn you, Al Davis." And he was just absolutely convinced Al was listening to everything he was telling him at halftime. George Allen was, you know, another guy that supposedly cheated all the time, Bill, that, you know, he and the Cowboys would accuse each other all the time of doing something to spy on practices. I mean, the Cowboys got to a point where when they played the Redskins, there was this motel overlooking the practice field in Dallas. They take up all the upper rooms, buy them all out, because they wouldn't allow any Redskin spies supposedly to camp out, because they were so convinced that George would buy a room and have a spy camping out on their practices. I mean, it's great stuff, but this one was caught so red-handed, and it was so much of a violation of trying to at least maintain some purity of the rules that, I think it's a lot more serious than what we've been talking about.
Will the punishment that has been assessed by the commissioner discourage other coaches and other organizations from engaging in this sort of thing?
I would think so. Again, I would like to have seen harsher, but yeah, I think at least if nothing else, it shows the rest of the teams that, you know, there is somebody out there watching us and looking for these things, and so maybe we better not try to push that envelope. And I think if that's going to accomplish everybody backing off, if there's other people, I don't know if there's other teams doing this. I know there's other teams trying to steal signals. I'm not so sure there's other teams videotaping them, but at the same time, I'm not going to say there isn't. But yeah, I would think at least for a while here, you're going to see anyone who had that thought, who has been trying to do it, is going to stop because they can't take a chance.
You know, I'm wondering, based on the stories that you've told, whether the problem isn't really many people cheating. It's more coaching paranoia. If all coaches think somebody is trying to put something over on them, they're going to try to do the putting over first.
Oh, sure. And that's it. I mean, it's one-upmanship. It's you know, if they're trying to get away with something, I better try to get away with it, too, and maybe I better find even a better way to get away with it. And so it builds upon each other, and sometimes the imagining that someone else is doing something to me or to my team to try to get an edge leads you to do something even if the other team wasn't doing it. But this world that has been created in sports, team sports, to win at all costs, doing anything possible to get that one little edge that you might need to win a game, and one win gets you into the playoffs. One win wins the Super Bowl. So it's important stuff in their minds. That's what they're getting paid to do, and they're going to do everything they can, obviously, to win.
For many years, Paul Attner was a football reporter for the Sporting News, and now he watches games from his couch in Herndon, Virginia, and some weekends he doesn't watch any games at all, which sounds like an even better gig to me. Paul, thanks again for joining me.
Hey, thanks, Bill. My pleasure.
Fifteen years ago, at a sold-out Kings Park Stadium in Durban, the newly integrated South African national team celebrated its return to international soccer competition with a 1-0 win at home against Cameroon. FIFA, soccer's governing body, had suspended South Africa in 1962 on account of its apartheid policies. 3 years ago, the former pariah state was awarded the 2010 World Cup, the first such competition to be played on African soil. But only a game's Ken Shulman found that in this land of many colors, sport is still a matter of black and white.
James Sobey stuffs his stocky frame into his black Orlando Pirates blazer. Squinting through pale blue cataracts, the 78-year-old former midfielder points towards a faded 1953 team photo on the wall of his Soweto home.
This one is the one that we beat anybody in South African football, Orlando Pirates.
And how many are alive today?
One, James Sobey. Bayang umthetho, the old history of ball.
James Sobey is a ghost of South Africa's soccer past. Broke and half blind, he lives for the 1 or 2 days every year when the Pirates send a car to take him to Orlando Stadium in Soweto. Waxing nostalgic in Zulu, peppered with pre-war British schoolboy slang, Sobey remembers how tickets to Pirate matches cost 4 bob, that he'd played with some white folks who were good chaps, but the government put a stop to that. He recalls crowds of 50,000 pouring into Orlando Stadium every Sunday from the black townships surrounding Johannesburg, and that he and his mates played for love, not for money.
We play football at halftime. They give us oranges. They throw them. We're happy with that orange.
Fans still turn out in droves for the Orlando Pirates, South Africa's oldest soccer team. At this away match against Ajax Cape Town, the visiting Pirates have outdrawn the home team 10-1, even though they're based 800 miles away. With their black T-shirts, Pirate flags, their plastic Vuvuzela trumpets blaring, the Pirate fans are hard to miss. As is another thing, nearly the entire crowd here at Cape Town's Athlone Stadium is black. A crew of workmen unfurls a giant tarp over the lawn at the stately cricket stadium in Newlands. Only a few miles separate this affluent white suburb from the ramshackle black and colored township surrounding Athlone. But the two Cape Town neighborhoods are worlds apart. Andre Odendal is chief executive at Newlands Cricket and the author of several books on sport and resistance in South Africa. He says all three British games, rugby, cricket, and soccer, were initially popular with all South African races. It was only after industrialization and massive black migration to the townships surrounding South Africa's major cities that soccer turned monochrome.
It's true to say, like the world over, that it is a working-class game that became popular in the townships. And by the 1940s and 50s, it had developed a strong identity and a popular base.
Odendal notes there is nothing unique in a country's underclass turning to soccer. What is novel in South Africa, he says, is how township fans were mobilized in the fight against apartheid.
And it was exactly post-World War, with the Declaration of Human Rights and the beginnings of anti-colonial movements throughout the world, that Nelson Mandela and the Youth League of the ANC started using this new urban base to argue for more militant politics to bring an end to white rule.
From early on, soccer was the sport of protest for South Africa's non-whites. Mohandas Gandhi was active in the Transvaal Indian Football Association, and in 1903 ran unsuccessfully for his presidency. During his years on Robben Island, Nelson Mandela helped his fellow prisoners establish the Mahaya Football Association. The fans who packed Orlando Stadium every Sunday came to root for their Pirates, but they also came to rally against the racist regime. Under apartheid, South African soccer players competed in 3 segregated leagues, white, black, and colored for those of mixed race. Today they play in a single multiracial league and command the highest salaries on the continent. League matches are broadcast in English, Xhosa, and Zulu. Bafana Bafana, the South African national team, features black, white, and colored stars. But the local media devotes twice as much attention to rugby and cricket, traditionally white sports, as it does to South African soccer. Premier League teams with strong township roots, like the Pirates, draw tens of thousands of fans. Other teams in white or mixed areas count their paying customers in the hundreds. More significantly, corporate South Africa, still firmly in the hands of the country's whites, remains on the sidelines, despite the upcoming World Cup. John Comitas is CEO of Ajax Cape Town. He says the problem isn't that the sport is seen to be black.
I think it's because there's a perception of it being disorganized and the perception of it not being professional enough, and they have an attitude that they would be putting their money in a black pit, and the owners will end up buying fancy cars and not worrying about running the club correctly.
Ajax Cape Town is a new model of South African club, a joint venture with Ajax Amsterdam. Ajax Cape Town develops African talent for its Dutch parent and for other European teams. Kamita says the lack of strong corporate backing puts South African players at a disadvantage.
We are developing players that have never played on grass. The fields are too bumpy. We don't have strikers in this country because the fields that we play and practice on are not smooth. The ball doesn't run. You need 2-3 touches to the ball to get it under control because you're playing in poor conditions. You can never develop players under those conditions to play total football.
The barriers dividing South Africa's three major sports reflect deeper social divisions, apartheid trenches that still scar the landscape. The majority of South Africa's 35 million blacks still live in poverty. The majority of the country's 3 million whites live behind armored gates and electrified wire. There are other countries with similar gaps between haves and have-nots, but nowhere else do those fault lines cut so neatly across color and across sport. The complexion of those who play or follow soccer, rugby, and cricket in South Africa is probably of little consequence. But as these three games seem to be a meter of change in this still stratified country, it makes all the difference in the world. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Soweto, South Africa.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. No good can come of an email that starts, "Dear Bill, what planet are you on right now?" That's how Andrew McGee of Norfolk, Massachusetts began his missive, urging me to forswear the games about which we've been talking and to, quote, "get with the cool guys and girls and watch some rugger." Mr. McGee's point is that the Rugby World Cup is currently being contested in France and that Only a Game should be paying attention. Unhappily, our correspondent in France is, not. But we trust the 20 nations involved will put on a great show. Of Amy Mayer's story on drum major camp, Matt Zawoski, who listens to Only a Game on his iPod in Portugal, wrote, "I had chills run up and down my arms. I attended George Parks' drum major academy back in the summer of 1989. I now practice medicine in Portugal. I often think back to George Parks' thoughts as a way to guide me through my professional life. Thanks for your insightful stories." Many people from Georgia, South Carolina, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, and Kansas wrote to kick our football analyst Dan Wetzel when he was down. Dan dared to opine that Michigan would probably crush Appalachian State when the two teams met on the gridiron 2 weeks ago. It didn't work out as Dan said it would. That, Kanya Summerlin, Donna Heald, Chris Trossel, Joe Schmidt, David German, Karen Grasso, and Michael Konopka, among others, is why they play the games. You've had your fun, now stop gloating. We also heard from Kent Smith, who listens to Only a Game on Vermont Public Radio. He didn't have the patience to wait for last week's program, during which I spoke to Bud Collins, who was at the U.S. Open tennis tournament in New York. Of the previous week's show, Mr. Smith wrote, "I can't believe that this morning you did not make a single mention of the U.S. Open tennis tournament and that you wasted time with marching bands and an activity that only the sodden brain dead would consider worth watching, NASCAR. Please get your act together." Bite your tongue, Mr. Smith, or I'll tell the NASCAR fans where you live in Vermont. You can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, sports worsts. Try saying that three times fast. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Now who's the most admirable NFL coach of all?
Come back with me, Bill, to the golden days of July of 1972, when all the smart people said, why would Richard Nixon break into the headquarters? He's going to win by a lot anyway.
I believe it was 49 states.
Why did they do that? Why does Bill Belichick illegally videotape somebody on the sidelines when he's already been caught at it before and within 15 miles of the commissioner of the NFL's office? For the same reason that dogs do things like that they do.
Because he can.
Exactly. This is an embarrassment. I believe the punishment was too light. I think he should have been suspended for at least one game. Just for the sheer unmitigated and completely predictable arrogance it took for him to do it anyway after he'd been caught once and after the entire league had been warned 2 days earlier.
In far more encouraging football news, Kevin Everett, the Buffalo Bills tight end who broke his neck and suffered a major spinal cord injury during last weekend's game against the Broncos, appears to be dramatically improving. I don't know about you, Charlie. I saw the replay. It was hard to avoid, and I was sure Everett's prognosis would not be nearly so good.
No, this is a remarkable job of trauma work on the field and in the hospital by these guys. The level of technology and medical innovation that was brought to bear on this case and produced the rather astonishing results we're seeing already, and with any luck we'll see in the future. It's a measure of how far we've come.
In China, the U.S. women's soccer team shut out Sweden on Friday morning after drawing with North Korea in their first game. The U.S. looks like it will be safely through, but maybe the bigger story of the first round so far is how close so many of the games have been.
Yeah, there have been some wacky scores, but at the same time, you got Argentina, which got buried in its first match, played Japan to a 1-0. And you've got the plucky North Koreans, about whom we know nothing, tying America and then winning their second game against Nigeria.
In a case not entirely unfamiliar this week, Charlie, team officials from Denmark are demanding more answers after two Chinese men with video cameras were caught hiding behind a two-way mirror in the room where Denmark was about to hold a strategy session. Do you think the men had taken tips from Bill Belichick?
I don't know, but what a letdown it must have been for the two guys who said, hey, you're going to be behind a two-way mirror with the Denmark women's soccer team. And then they find out it's a meeting room.
Oh, man.
Man, I'm not taking this job.
And, Charlie, it has finally happened. We have hit the sports spying trifecta. So maybe you could finish the trifecta for us.
The McLaren Formula One team. Now, there are fines. Bill Belichick's writing a hefty check. Of course, Bill Belichick has been writing hefty checks to a number of people in the last couple of years. The McLaren Racing team has to write a check for $100 million for having stolen or at least obtained illegal, leaked, secret technical documents belonging to the Ferrari team. Now, first of all, this is really James Bond stuff. The other stuff is sort of creepy, peepy camera stuff. This is purloining documents, tiny, maybe they hid them in pumpkins, tiny, tiny little cameras. This is a great story.
The start of the NBA season is still more than a month away, but already things are looking down for the Portland Trail Blazers. Greg Oden will miss his entire rookie season following microfracture knee surgery, which sounds awful even though I don't know exactly what it is. Is this yet another unlucky draft pick for Portland?
Yeah, well, to be on the optimistic side, it's exactly the same surgery that Amari Stoudemire of Phoenix had when he's come back, certainly, to his robust talent before. It's a real bad break for the Portland Trail Blazers, who did their best to clean house, get all the Jailblazer people out of there. And now, with Greg Oden, who everybody liked having around the league, gone for the year, you're dealing with a team that has Joel Prisbilla as its center and LaMarcus Aldridge as its power forward. It's just going to be what should have been a really good year for Portland is turning out to be a really bad year.
On Thursday night, the Phoenix Mercury beat the Detroit Shock by a point to force a fifth game in the WNBA playoffs, the championship series. Detroit has the home arena going for them. Do they make it two straight crowns?
Yes, they do. The Mercury had a terrific game the other night. Cappy Pondexter and Diana Taurasi were great down the stretch, but Detroit will win at home. Detroit will fill the building and have a very raucous crowd and will win their title again.
I have before me a story headlined, "Bettman has drawn a line in the sand." Is the National Hockey League so desperate that it's going to play its games in sand this winter?
Well, they are playing a few outdoors this year. Is it a red line or a blue line? Do we know? Or is it a crease line? Is it drawn a crease in the sand?
I don't have the article in front of me anymore. You tell me.
Yeah, a drunk hockey player named Mark Bell ran into a pickup truck and took off a year ago. He's pled out. He's going to serve 6 months in jail. And the NHL has suspended him for 15 games. On top of everything else that's happened to him, Gary Bettman has looked at the Roger Goodell precedent, I think, and decided he's going to flex his muscles. If a guy flexes his muscles and nobody's paying attention to his league, does he really make a sound, I guess is the question.
Speaking of less than exemplary behavior in the National Hockey League, the Buffalo Sabres suspended defenseman Teppo Nieminen this week. Nieminen has a heart condition about which the Sabres knew when they signed him to a $2.6 million one-year guaranteed contract. What exactly is their excuse for refusing to pay the guy?
He's been suspended without pay for failing to report to camp an adequate physical condition. Oh, if the National Hockey League Players Association was an actual union, they could be beating people over the head with this. Nieminen's an alternate captain. He's had two heart surgeries. There was no question that he revealed this to the team with the Sabres when they signed him. This is just embarrassing.
Tiger Woods has decided to skip the PGA Grand Slam in Bermuda in order to spend more time with his daughter, Sam Alexis, who was born in June. The official statement indicates that the PGA supports Tiger's decision. But given the ratings hit golf takes every time the game's number one player takes a weekend off, I'm wondering if the PGA should start looking into the possibility of building on-site daycare centers at their tournament.
I think the PGA should look into the possibility of naming Sam Alexis a vice president or something, so she has to be
at every tournament.
I love the PGA supports Tiger's decision, much in the same way I support the fact that it snows in January.
And finally, Charlie, today's final story comes in the mail from a fan of Rhinelander, Wisconsin. We recently welcomed a new station from Rhinelander, and in honor of that accomplishment, Michael Wilson has sent us a framed postcard of Rhinelander's mascot, the Hodag, and I think I'll hand this over to you.
Let me see.
I'll let you.
I don't have enough pictures of Hodags. And this is a great freaking Hodag right here. This is one of the best Hodags I've ever seen.
It's the only one I've ever...
Thank you, Michael. I've seen the Hodag in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, too. But came Sunday morning when the sun came up, I didn't see the Hodag anymore.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In these days when our games are riddled with embarrassment and incarceration, The Worst of Sports, a new book subtitled Chumps, Cheats, and Chokers from the Games We Love, is guaranteed to be obsolete very soon. But it's here anyway, and I'm joined now in the studio by Matthew Rossetti, one of the men who compiled this collection of worsts. Matt, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
What provoked you and your co-authors, Jesse Lemovsky and Charlie DeMarco, to embark on this project?
Well, I think when you're trying to create anything, you go for originality. And while you wouldn't think The Worst of Sports is a unique concept, I don't think a book has ever really been done as far as the scope that we tried to do it. We tried to focus on the three major sports, bring in the Olympics, golf, tennis. So I think as far as covering the variety of topics that we did, pretty unique.
A lot of the worsts that you've identified are bound to strike some folks as subjective. It can't be avoided. For example, you have identified the 1956 transaction that sent Ed McCauley from the Boston Celtics to the St. Louis Hawks as one of the worst trades ever. But Boston fans are very likely to disagree.
Absolutely, and that's the beauty of sports, is that no matter how definitive the stats are in front of you, everything is going to be viewed as subjective by one person.
Well, right, and trades, especially this trade that I'm referring to, brought Bill Russell to the Boston Celtics. So as far as they're concerned, it's the best.
Absolutely.
Not
fair.
The worst.
Fair, but there is absolutely a worst part of it. So
okay.
That's, I think, where we're headed.
One of your candidates for worst choke by an individual player is Jose Mesa, pitching for the Cleveland Indians in the seventh game of the World Series 10 years ago. How did Mr. Mesa achieve that distinction?
Well, I think blowing a game in the ninth inning in the World Series was somewhat unprecedented.
And, yeah, one of the things I learned from your book, as a matter of fact, nobody had ever blown a lead in the ninth inning in the seventh game of the World Series before.
And he is the one to have done it. And to be honest, I didn't know it either. I'm not a stat buff. This was one of the things that I learned throughout the research and writing the book, and it's fascinating. Mm.
The Boston College football team of 1942 is a candidate for worst collapse by a whole team, but there's a real O. Henry ending to that particular story of failure.
How about it? A tremendous upset with a regional rival, Holy Cross, beating them in that game. But Boston College had a party planned at the Coconut Grove later that evening in Boston, which, as many people in New England and maybe throughout the country know, that ended up being one of the worst fire tragedies in our country's history. And Boston College, having it been a celebration party, decided not to attend, considering they lost the game. And as luck would have it, for them, not for the other people in attendance,
Hundreds of people
died. Right. And Boston College was not there. And as we say, they were able to wake up the next morning, although bummed about their loss, pretty happy that they were still alive.
Some of the categories that you've invented for this book seem, at best, unkind. Whose idea was the all-rotund pitching staff?
Well, anything that's in the book, we all signed off on. But, yeah, I'm sure some of the guys on that list aren't going to be entirely happy about it. But others sort of embraced it. You know, Rich Garces, El Guapo, beloved by the Boston public. I don't think he was trying too hard to lose weight, so I think he was okay with it.
In the chapter titled When Fans Attack, The Worst of Fan Projectiles, you provide tales of fans who have thrown baseballs, batteries, and bottles onto the field. I was familiar with that stupid tactic. But yeah. I acknowledge that I had never before heard about one particularly unkosher projectile that somebody at Nou Camp Stadium in Barcelona threw onto the field during a soccer game.
A pig's head.
Who would bring a pig's head into the stadium just in case there might be provocation to throw it onto the field?
Apparently security,
I don't understand.
Apparently security is somewhat more lax than it is in the modern-day U.S. stadiums.
Unbelievable. The pig's head was bad, but you guys make a case that the worst performance by a whole stadium full of fans occurred in Cleveland. We're back to Cleveland.
Back to Cleveland.
In the spring of 1974. Now, in defense of those Indians fans, they did have an excuse, sort of.
Well, when you're gorging yourself with 10-cent beers, you're getting a little loose. And, you know, I don't think you're on top of your game, so to speak. So Indians fans ended up throwing a lot of things on the field, including themselves, and chairs at their own players by the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So
there was a story about a Bowie knife that ended up gonging in the ground behind somebody. Yeah.
Absolutely. There was... Yeah, it pretty much fell apart pretty quickly.
10-cent beer night, maybe the worst idea anybody ever had for a promotion in a stadium.
The best part about it is there were three of them scheduled, and even after that one went bad, Indians management, not surprising, wanted to go forward with the next two.
Major League Baseball said, maybe not.
You know what? I don't think so.
Given the sports stories making the news today, a photo that you reproduced toward the end of The Worst of Sports seems to me particularly appropriate, though it also seems wonderfully quaint at this time. Was it easy to decide to include in the book the image of Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa costumed as bulging Roman gladiators?
It was one of the better finds that we could have dug up. It was a beautiful picture, and I think it captures sort of the tone of Major League Baseball and what they're going through right now, and it's a never-ending story, and it's still leaking out as we speak, and it'll continue to drag on with the Mitchell investigation, and it really captured specifically that 1998 home run chase moment that we wrote about in the book.
You spoke about the process of researching this book. Did you end up with personal favorites?
Well, the one you mentioned, 10-Cent Beer Night, was a wonderful piece, I think, in researching that. Another one is a piece called Blood in the Water, about the 1956 semifinal water polo match between Hungary and the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
More because of the historical and political backdrop behind that. And what had happened was, a couple months before the games, there was a Hungarian uprising against the Soviet communist control, and basically, the Soviet Union, the only way the Soviet Union could, is roll in with 200,000 soldiers and tanks and crush it, and killed thousands of Hungarians and ended up hanging their prime minister, Imre Nagy. It wasn't the world of text messages and World Wide Web back then, so the water polo team from Hungary, who had been training in the mountains, never even knew about it until maybe a week or so before their match against the Soviet Union. And they were faced with a decision. Do we get revenge for our brothers that died in the street, or do we try and win the match? Well, the Hungarian players decided to do both. So this thing, and one of the quotes in the book, is it turned into a full-on naval skirmish in the water, and it did. It was blow by blow from the beginning, and there was literally blood in the water. And Hungary won the match 4-0 and laid a few Borscht Swishes on the and knuckle sandwiches on the Soviet players.
Given the way things are going in sports these days, are you guys already working on a sequel to The Worst in Sports? They're coming at us fast and furious.
You know, one of the things about this book is you could never do an all-encompassing or all-inclusive book. I mean, this thing, it's probably why Random House agreed to publish it, because they foresaw a series down the road. And I don't blame them. And hopefully it works that way, because I had so much fun and we had so much fun doing it. It's just an all-encompassing Worst of Sports book would be impossible to do, because you could write 10,000 pages.
Matt Rossetti is one of the co-authors responsible for The Worst in Sports, Chumps, Cheats, and Chokers from the Games We Love, published by Ballantine Books. Matt, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see Ken Schulman's photos from South Africa or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. In our final word, Tampa Tribune writer Carter Gaddis explains the difference between the current Devil Rays and those lovable losers, the New York Mets of the early 60s.
No, because the Devil Rays have never been particularly lovable. They just lose is all.
It must be a delightful theme to cover. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org.